Welcome to Driven Minds. I'm Gigi, and this is a Type 7 podcast. Our guest today is Michelle Williams. Michelle is a singer and actress, best known as one-third of Destiny's Child. Together, they sold more than 60 million records and won 3 Grammys. After the group officially disbanded in 2006, Michelle had a vibrant solo career, releasing 4 solo albums and starring in both TV and Broadway shows. Michelle has a podcast called Checking In, where she invites guests to share intimate experiences with their mental health, which might also explain why she slipped into host mode more than once on our episode. So here it is, my conversation with Michelle Williams, recorded live in Atlanta, Georgia. You were born Rockford, Illinois, 1979.
Oh, yes. Yep.
For anyone who did not grow up in Rockford in the 80s and 90s, what kind of place is it? What's the local bar? Are we Bowling Friday? Like, give me the lowdown.
So it is your Midwestern town, obviously Illinois, and people did go bowling on Friday nights, I believe it was. There was a bowling alley called Don Carter Lanes on East State Street where people would go bowling. We didn't have a lot to do to the point where people would just hang out in the parking lot of a gas station and show off their cars or something like that. So, yeah, Rockford is pretty cool. It's home of the legendary band Cheap Trick that's been inducted to the Hall of Fame. Let's see, Danica Patrick.
Okay.
Race car driver.
Michelle Williams.
Okay, if you want to say so. Yes, I didn't want to just, you know, just say my own name. But, you know.
And what was the atmosphere of your childhood?
It was totally mixed. Family trips, church all the time. Of course, school. I can't say that I hung out with friends a lot because my mom, she kind of didn't let us hang out with friends unless it was like church related. But not a lot of hanging out. Everything wasn't great because I think that's when depression set in for me. I think around the 7th grade. I'm giving the balance where it was good, but then, you know, you have a home where folks aren't getting along and what that can produce. So it was definitely balanced.
So it sounds like you were a bit of an introverted kid, or?
I'm getting more introverted now. I say since about 2013, I've been kind of going a little more inward, or I notice it more.
I'm the exact same, actually.
I notice it more. But as a child, maybe you're right. Maybe I always was, but just didn't know it.
I mean, I guess you couldn't have been too introverted because you also started singing when you were around 7, right?
I was singing around the age of 7. But, you know, some creative children are introverted. We know how to get up and perform, but we don't want everybody in our face afterwards.
Totally.
Now, my family, my cousins and my aunts and uncles, because I knew them, I was okay.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I'm learning as we're studying creatives that some are very introverted. But yeah, I started singing at the age of 7. My first solo in church was at that age.
And did you foresee you doing this professionally at that age, or were you just like, not? Okay.
It was just cute to do, you know, to be the child that can sing in church.
Yeah.
The trajectory of the life that I had planned was to go to college, get a good job, get married, have children, and live that Midwestern life.
Right.
I knew.
In Rockford.
Well, I wanted to live in the city of Chicago. I would move to Chicago, but I never thought of moving to Georgia, California, or Florida. You know, I want a beach house. I never thought to, at that age, I was like, no, I just want to move to the big city of Chicago, which was 60 miles away from Rockford.
But you ended up going to Illinois State and pursuing a degree in criminal justice.
Yes.
And then you dropped out to pursue singing.
Yes.
So at that point, did you have anything lined up, or was it just like, universe, take me where I need to go?
I started singing background from Monica when my second year last semester was done.
Of college. How'd that come about?
A friend of mine that was one of her musicians found my number. I think he said, I in a bottom of a moving box or something.
What?
And he called it to see if it was still my number. And it was. And he said, hey, I'm about to go on the road with Monica. I mean, that ain't why he called, but the conversation led into, hey, I'm about to, you know, go on the road with Monica. I was like, what? You know, I was like, if she needs a background singer, tell her I said hi and that, you know, I'm the one she needs or whatever. Right. He calls me not too long after and said, she's having auditions tomorrow in Atlanta. Can you get to Atlanta? I was like, I can't afford a next day airline ticket. Those are very expensive. He said, well, my cousin Gladys works for United Airlines. Let me see if she can get you a buddy pass. And I got a buddy pass. She was able to get me the buddy pass. And I flew to Atlanta to do the audition and was on the road with Monica for about 6 months. Wow. And that's how. And so Destiny's Child, they were like the opening act on a few of those dates.
Crazy that Destiny's Child was ever an opening act.
Destiny's Child was the opening act. Matter of fact, the tour was called the Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon, All That Music and More tour.
Kenan and Kel were my everything.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Any like 90s child, I feel.
Yeah.
Relates to that. So you were on this Nickelodeon tour.
On the Nickelodeon tour. Matter of fact, I think Nick Cannon was hosting, doing some hosting. It was a huge tour. Nick Cannon and I, whenever we get the chance to see each other, he calls me Tanitra because that's what my first name is, Tanitra. And so he's right. Like, I know you as Tanitra. I don't know who this Michelle is. So we knew, he knew me from back then before I was even in Destiny's Child. And so that's how that happened. And so Destiny's Child opening, being the opening act. Well, one of Monica's dancers was Destiny's Child's choreographer as well. And so when Destiny's Child was looking to transition, do some changes, Janella Segura told Beyonce and Kelly and Miss Tina about me and said, I think you should, you know, take a look at her and see if, you know, I'm paraphrasing. She did not say take a look at her.
Yeah, yeah. So, give her a shot.
You can't say nothing nowadays.
I know.
You can't. So what you mean? You had to stand and they took a look at you? No, that's not what happened, everybody. So that's what happened. And so I flew to Houston. I sang for them. We went to Papa Do's and had some good old Cajun food. And kind of waited around to see what was going to happen. And they needed of me. And film Say My Name video. I gotta tell you what happened with that. So I was supposed to go shadow the county coroner.
Wait. You were shadowing a coroner.
And I was, before you, I was like, I don't want to make her choke on the water she's drinking, y'all. Y'all, put Gillian, I was.
Safely landed.
So because I still had interest in film, in finishing my criminal justice degree.
So she's still in college too.
I was still considering I needed to get back in school.
Right.
So my uncle says, who's a practicing physician, he said, T, I don't know if you sure this is really what you want to do, because that field, you know, you're kind of going to be seeing some gruesome scenes and bodies, you know. And so he said, you know, let's see if I can get you into, you know, shadow the county coroner.
Yeah, see what you're dealing with.
And so I had an appointment, and I had to make the choice that day. Do I shadow the coroner, or do I get on a plane to L.A. to film Say My Name?
But you're already in the band, right?
No.
You're not.
No.
So this was like a trial
period.
This
was like
sorts.
A trial period. I wasn't even an official member of Destiny's Child at the time.
That iconic video.
Mm-mm, I wasn't considered official.
Okay. So obviously she chose Say My Name in L.A.
I chose Say My Name in L.A. and became official. And I never got to shadow the county coroner.
I love that you're making a sad face over that.
I never got to.
But did you ever want to go back and pursue criminal justice?
Absolutely.
You did. Okay, so that was still something that stuck with you.
I did. To this day. Last night I was watching Dateline. Like, watch Dateline or 2020. More than even anything music related.
All right, so you're like a Law and Order girl.
Every episode, every SVU episode, I'm in. I'm watching.
You film Say My Name, but you're also joining with a bit of drama because you're replacing one of the members, mm-hmm. right? On top of that, you're not joining any band.
Mm-hmm.
You are stepping into a group that's already successful. They're signed to Columbia Records. Mm-hmm. They have three mm-hmm. hit songs out. Mm-hmm. Bugaboo's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you win a Grammy within the first year of joining the group. I mean, how was that transition for you? Because yeah. that is a thrill ride.
That's been, what, 23 years ago? I probably didn't see it like that till you're just now saying something. You did all that within the first year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I literally hopped on a moving train. And I was glad to be a team player and to be used wherever it was needed. Beyonce and Kelly ended up being within those first couple months. Well, actually, the first day of me meeting them, I remember saying, if I don't get the chance to be in this group, I met two of the most lovely young ladies, right? And they were in a position of dreams being shattered because they didn't know if they would make it as a duo. Because that was an alternative for them to just go and be a duo. So I'm like, well, how can I come in and just be a team player and help them? I wasn't coming in to be the star, I was like, let's go. What do I need to do? You're literally coming on a team.
Right.
An NBA winning team. Mm. At this point, I don't care who's who. How are we winning? And I think that could be said to people who are going into situations where it's already established. Just be grounded in your role. Mm-hmm. The goal is to win.
And during that time, you said you didn't have a moment to even understand anything that was going on with you and to you and the ride you were on. Were there any moments where you did have any sort of doubt? Mm-hmm. Like, what am I in?
Yeah. And at that time, now that I've been in therapy, like, I didn't know about a polyvagal nerve. I didn't know about a amygdala and all that stuff and how to regulate your nervous system. And sometimes you don't even know that you're in a state of anxiety because it's first of all, I grew up in a state of anxiety. And then you go and work in an industry that's anxiety ridden. So it felt familiar.
Right. That like state of fight or flight is just your everyday.
It was survival. It was like, okay, we're on a plane today. Okay, I didn't go to sleep till midnight, but I got to be in hair and makeup at 5 a.m. There was no cute time off.
It's interesting because as the group was getting established, I'm sure you also were trying to establish yourself in terms of your identity in some way. And this is just conjecture, but you're what, like 21, 22 at this time, Michelle, right?
Like 20 years old, I believe, when I first stepped foot in the group.
So your early 20s are the most transformative years of your life in general, right? You're trying to figure out what you want, mm-hmm. who you are. Mm-hmm. And in your case,
mm-hmm.
I could imagine that you have record executives, a team of publicists, like an entire village mm-hmm. telling you
mm-hmm.
who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Did your vision and their vision align at all? Or did you feel that you had to conform to a vision that was not your own?
No. Like I said, it's literally going into somebody's house. The pictures and stuff are already set.
Mm.
You go and have a seat.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't until the last album that we did that I felt like I could have some say and some input. That was me projecting, by the way.
Right.
That was me. But I felt like, no, they were already established. Don't come in here trying to change stuff. They've got a lot going on. Just come in, see where you fit in. And my mind was, we got to win.
Right.
There's a lot being said about these girls that the world don't even know. Like, I know. Uh-huh. We got to win.
But that last album was around 4 or 5 years after you joined, mm-hmm. right?
It took that amount of time for me to feel like I belonged.
Mm.
Kelly and B already knew. Mm-hmm. They were like, we selected you. We chose you. We love you. Like, so that was on me. That was me. I should have felt that way on the Survivor album. I'm on that album. We helped create that album together.
It's so interesting hearing you say that you felt like the odd one out because my best friend and I swore by Destiny's Child, like you were our GD religion. 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade. made up dances to your song. Mm-hmm, for us, mm-hmm, it was mm-hmm. Kelly Michelle Beyonce. Mm-hmm. It was the three of you. That was Destiny's Child. Mm-hmm, and it's so mm-hmm. interesting hearing
yeah.
that during this time you felt like the odd one out because you really were the only one seeing it that way.
Well, yeah. I mean, it wasn't them making me feel that way. It took time for me to feel like, okay, I'm solid. I got my footing.
Right.
But it took some development of myself. I was the first one to put out a solo album. I was practically thrown into the group, and then you're thrown out to do your first album. I'm like, what am I doing? So in between that time, I had some growth as a solo artist. Mm-hmm. So when I came into Destiny's Child again for the Destiny Fulfilled album, when we came back together, I kind of knew who I wanted to be.
Right.
As a member of Destiny's Child, who I am, what I'm bringing, mm-hmm. and have that confidence that, okay, let's come out, let's do it again.
And when you did have that confidence and you did know what you mm-hmm. were bringing, did mm-hmm. the dynamic of the group change at all?
I think so, because everybody was confident. Everybody versus me being a deer in headlights. we knew our flavor. We knew what seasoning we added to the pot.
You've also said that you were at times insecure about your voice and place in Destiny's Child. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious what this insecurity was born from, if anything mm-hmm. in particular.
Well, it's something that's already established. Beyonce and Kelly already had fans. Mm-hmm. Even the two young ladies who exited the group, they had fans. And then here I'm coming in like, it wasn't me. I'm just here to, we just try to win, y'all. We just yeah. try to win. And the development that Beyonce and Kelly had together for years, to this day, people say, I can't distinguish whose voice is who. Beyonce and Kelly sound so much alike. And then here I come in like, oh, that's Michelle's voice.
You really think your voice was that different?
Yeah.
Interesting. Just from like a normal fan's voice, I couldn't always tell.
Yeah, I know how to blend. But even in blending, you no matter how distinct yeah. your voice is, when you're in a group, you need to know how to blend.
Right.
So I knew how to blend. I'd been in groups in church. I've been in the choir for years. So I knew I had a very churchy, gospel-y, raspy tone that mm-hmm. stood out from the buttery, smooth that Beyonce and Kelly have.
You've mentioned that it was an incredible group dynamic. You're growing. You're part of the team. The girls are wonderful. That said, what was the most stressful moment in that group that you can remember for those 5 years?
I have to say, it wasn't a lot of bad stress. It was normal stress that comes along with that magnitude of work, mm-hmm. right? We've never argued.
To this day, you've never argued.
I mean, never have been disrespectful. I believe even if we were, if you do it healthy, you could still have relationship years later. But part of us still having a relationship today is the respect that we always carried for one another.
I mean, it's pretty incredible. You don't hear any member of any group of your stature ever mm-hmm. saying that.
Yeah. And that's the honest truth. That's not some made up answer yeah. PR told us to say. It is fact. We've never had an argument. Like, Kelly knows me and B aren't morning people. So she's never going to come in, whoop da da.
Right.
Give me 2 hours and then you can yeah. whoop de doo. Yeah. Right? Or I know Kelly loves breakfast in the morning. She's the breakfast that she wants. She's on her day off. She's going to want to go to the Eiffel Tower while she's in Paris. I want to be in the bed. We kind of know each other. Or if her favorite color is purple, and say a stylist is styling us for an award show, and they come in with a rack and it's got a purple dress on it, I'm not going to go put on the purple dress when I know Kelly loves purple. The focus is to win.
Yeah.
Am I doing or saying anything that keeps us from winning?
Right.
Vice versa.
Yeah.
The goal is to win. We said we would think like dudes. Dudes can play basketball. Y'all could be in this studio having a war about who the best engineer of all time is. Y'all could be in here arguing about that. And then afterwards, you could be like, man, I'm hungry. You want some wings? But girls, we gonna take it. We ain't gonna speak for 4 days. But we totally said we will not do that. If it ever came to the point of a disagreement, we're gonna figure out, hey, I don't have to agree on who the best audio engineer is.
So did you guys make this kind of verbal pact?
Yeah.
You did? Upon joining.
Yeah, I'm telling you, we said we would kind of think like dudes because at that time, there were groups kind of, you know, having issues and not being able to work them out. And because maybe Destiny's Child had also kind of been in some type of drama, it's kind of like, okay, well, we know we got to communicate.
Right.
You know, and treat each other with respect and kindness.
Right.
So we got to win. Destiny's Child didn't need no more breakups. So we got to win.
How was your sleep on tour? And I'm asking because sleep is the factor of how my following day is going to go. If I feel like I'm going crazy, it's because I have not slept.
Oh, my sleep is healing. Oh, my God. When you have an infection, they want you to sleep.
Yeah.
When you're wounded, you have to sit and rest. Mm-hmm. Sleep is regenerative. So I don't play about my sleep. My boo likes to stay up and just talk. I let myself yawn right on FaceTime. Like, I gotta go to bed. I notice when I go to bed earlier, when I wake up earlier, my day, as far as how I feel mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, is better. Now, things are gonna happen where you work late, you get up and go to bed 1 a.m, you gotta be up at 5. I don't function well that way. I know people who can function well on 5 hours of sleep.
Well, you said you did when you would go, you know, you'd go to bed and then wake up at 5 for hair and makeup after 5 hours of sleep. Yeah, I was like, how is she dealing?
And that's why I never went to the Eiffel Tower when I was in Paris, because my days off were I was like in the Kelly bed. Go. Like, I was in the bed.
Right.
I like my sleep. I don't know what I'm going to do in marriage and he won't sex. I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to be like. I've got to sleep first so that I can be all that I need to be.
Morning sex is the answer, Michelle.
Girl, bye. You better let me wake up first. There's a verse in Cater to You where Kelly says, when you come home late, tap me on my shoulder, I'll roll over. You wrote that verse, Kelly. I didn't. You wrote that verse, not me.
For me, sex, 50% of a relationship is sexual connection with my partner.
Mm-hmm.
Because it helps every other area. It helps communication. It helps just like that lovey feeling. I mean, I'm a physical touch person. That's my love language.
It's your love language. Mm-hmm.
But sex is, for me, it's like, if you've got that, then it's like, and you don't have to work. I mean, you always have to work on everything. But the sex component, one of the most crucial.
Isn't that horrible, though, when the sex component is great,
oh, God.
But the other parts are horrible?
No reason to stay in a relationship. So, telling everyone this, including myself.
So, would you stay in a relationship if it was flip-flop?
If everything was
great communication, he respects you, he's faithful, all of that. He knows how to communicate, he's doing the work.
Oh, I just said yes, but I don't know, I'm kind of taking
But
it
if
back.
The other part wasn't that great, are you staying?
It's such a good question. I feel you could work on sex. I mean, how many times have you had sex with someone for the first time and it's been god-awful, like, oh my gosh, never doing this again. And then by the 10th or 20th time, it's like, this is incredible. I mean, for me, that happens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'd work on it. Okay. How about you?
I'm asking you. I'm asking you the question. You brought it up. So I just want to know for you.
Yeah. I think you can work on it. I think you can work on it.
Okay.
You've been open about suffering from depression since you were 13.
Mm-hmm.
That was also around the time that I developed OCD, and that was one of the scariest periods in my life. And I remember the first person that I told was my psychiatrist, and it was scary because I had no idea what was happening to my mind.
Mm.
I had no idea why I had to touch something like 15 times, and if it was 16, then it was the wrong amount of times, and I'd have to do the ritual all over again. But I remember telling my psychiatrist and seeing him unalarmed by my thoughts when I was so deeply petrified of them was so pacifying. And I'm curious who the first person you told about your depression and how that went down.
The first person I told, why do I think it was Beyonce's mom? Miss Tina. I told Matthew Knowles. Two different responses. Miss Tina was like, "We, you got to get in some therapy." And I was like, Black people go to therapy? I was like, what? I just thought it was a rich Caucasian perk. You get to go to therapy. Or I thought the extreme crazy people go to therapy. I'm neither. Mm-hmm. So that really helped me be open to the thought and idea of going to therapy. There are some people where at that time, if you were to tell them you're depressed, like when I told our manager at the time, he said, no, there's no way you can be depressed. I mean, y'all are touring. You got Barbie dolls. You just signed a multi-million dollar deal. You're like, you're fine. And I thought, you're right. Maybe I'm just tired. Now, I talked to him about this in like 2017.
To your manager?
Yeah. To Destiny's Child's manager.
Right.
He said, I am so sorry, Michelle. He said, had I knew then what I know now about mental health, he said, I would have gotten you the help you needed instantly. But in that time, people were like, no, you're fine. You're probably just tired. You're missing your family. And all that could have been true. Mm-hmm. You know, but I just didn't know how to handle that 13-year-old, that wounded 13-year-old that's now 21, with this extra fame and success, and learning that even me running away to go to college was to escape dysfunction. And I told the kids at University of Delaware the other day, success does not heal trauma. Mm-hmm. I said, how many of y'all escaped to college because you were escaping dysfunction because you want to run to success? About 100 of them raised their hands. Mm. And I affirmed them. I said, you're going to be great. You're going to be successful. You better make this tuition make sense. But I just want you to know that the success that you're going to have is not going to heal that 8-year-old girl. What it will do, it will help you to afford the resources you need for your healing.
Mm-hmm.
So had I known that at that age of me mentoring these kids, they're going to have a jump start, a bigger jump start before I did. I didn't have a depression diagnosis until I was in my 30s.
Right.
So imagine seventh grade Michelle coping all those years until I'm in my 30s. How you learn to cope. You like to be by yourself. So now, is it isolation or is it solitude? I love my solitude. So it ain't me isolating because I'm depressed. Now, right. It's I need it.
How else did the depression manifest when you were in Destiny's Child? Because the schedule was grueling, mm-hmm. right? During rehearsals,
it did manifest
promo.
Maybe until like time off, you know? It really didn't get bad until like 2012-ish, 2000. It really got dark.
Was there something that set that off? Or
a horrible relationship.
That does it.
It wasn't his fault, like he's a bad person, but I think just the time in that relationship where I was like, what are you doing all these years in this? What are you doing? And I think that kind of was, like I said, it was already there, but I think that relationship might have like, really exposed it all,
mm-hmm.
where that's when I began to really get help.
I had one like that when I was 20. It was an abusive relationship, 2021, and it just opened Pandora's box for me, right? Like all the anxiety, all of these mental issues that I had that were hidden within me,
mm-hmm.
a bad relationship will just, that's like Jack in the box. It's like that gopher game in the arcade where you like hit the gopher and another one keeps popping up. So I definitely hear you.
Yeah, you've got to surround yourself romantically, business-wise, regular friendships. I'm on this thing of safe people. I had to review this book by Dr. Henry Cloud called Safe People. You got to review that. Safe people, and not only them, but you. Are you safe?
Mm.
Are you safe with yourself? And then can people deem you as safe? It's ease. We're too grown to not have easy relationships.
Yeah. Well, especially
this
now.
Ain't seventh grade.
No, it is not.
We got to have ease in our relationships now.
I hear that your depression really worsened around 2013, but you know, you still were clearly going through it at a time that was so rigorous, right? Mm-hmm. Through Destiny's Child. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of this DBT concept called opposite action. Do you know about it?
Mm-mm.
The idea is you do the opposite of what your biological impulse is. So me, with OCD, for instance, if my OCD wants me to touch something 20 times, I touch it once.
Okay.
And you sit with that discomfort. The discomfort can sometimes be completely debilitating. But the idea is the feeling always subsides. So the idea with depression is you get out of bed, even though you just want to glue those goddamn blinds and put on a sleeping mask and lay there for 17 years like Rip Van Winkle. So it sounds like during Destiny's Child, you were doing the opposite of what your depression wanted you to do. And I'm curious if that helped at all by being accountable.
Oh, absolutely. I think it did. And at that time, I didn't have time to be depressed.
Right, exactly.
I couldn't have depression in the itinerary. We had to keep it moving. But it's so awesome that you say that because I was doing opposite action and didn't know that that's what I was doing.
You're ahead of the curve.
You know, to this day, I do that.
Mm.
You know, I make my bed. Every time I get out the bed, I make my bed.
It's crucial.
So that, you know, first of all, you might have clothes folded up or somewhere, but when you walk in and you see the biggest item in that room and it's organized and it's made up, it does something. It's amazing, right? So I make sure to make up my bed every morning because that's symbolic of the time where I was in bed for 6 weeks straight because of depression. It's like, nope, you're going to get out the bed. Even if you are having a low day, at least go downstairs, make your coffee, and sit on your sofa.
Mm-hmm.
Don't lay in the bed. But that's, this is not me judging someone's, but there was this thing where my uncle, like I said, who was he was a physician at the time when the depression had gotten really bad at first. He said, okay, so he said, I want you to make sure you eat at least a bowl of oatmeal in the morning. You know, because I was losing a lot of weight. He said, just eat some oatmeal. And he said, even if you have to get back in the bed, that's okay.
Yeah.
Because depression makes you stink. You don't want to take care of your hygiene. You don't want to brush your teeth. You want to shower. All you want to do is lay in the bed. Mm-hmm. I would get up to use the bathroom and that was it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so he said, why don't you just try, even if you just brush your teeth and get back in the bed, try that. So I would brush my teeth. Okay, get back in the bed. One morning though, Gillian, I brushed my teeth and I was like, the shower is behind you. Brush your teeth. Now get in the shower.
Mm.
So it went from brushing my teeth, taking a shower, to now I can go in the kitchen, make my coffee, get some oatmeal. And maybe if I get back in the bed, that's okay. But it was kind of like I was taking bigger steps.
Totally.
I love that I had to walk down the hill of my driveway and the mailbox was there to go get the mail. I went outside.
I don't know if the mailbox thing was a trick, but I also, when I was going through it, I needed coffee to start my day. Michelle, I made sure that there was never anything caffeinated in my house, so I'd be forced
to go out
to
and get
go
it. Amazing.
Outside.
Amazing, amazing.
And
I would put my phone in the kitchen so that I would have to get up and go to the kitchen and get my phone. And it forced me to make my coffee, make some breakfast, do my devotionals, and get my mind right. And so I'm encouraging people, even if you just got to brush your teeth and get back in the bed, that's okay. But people that have depression, sometimes the most smallest task is overwhelming. So I also tell people with depression, don't think about what all you got to do today.
Yes.
Focus on what you got to do between now and getting to the bathroom.
Yeah.
That's it. Sometimes that's all you can focus on. When people say, oh, I'm just taking it day by day. No, sometimes with depression, you're taking it second by second.
You said that you didn't have time to think about your depression in Destiny's Child. You also seem very high functioning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that high functioning element was also something that stood in my way. I was an editor at W. I was at Vogue before. I was a DJ, DJing for all the cool brands or whatever. So when everyone else looked at my life, they would tell me how great my life was. So then I tried to convince myself and to believe them that my life was so great, right? I mean, I'm sure it was...
Well, I don't want someone to think that because they have depression, they don't have a great life.
Well, that's true. And I'm happy that you're pointing that out.
Yeah, because you can still have that and.
I guess it was that I was functioning at such a high cost.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
I didn't have it in me to enjoy it. Like people would say, I can't believe you got that DJ gig with Louis Vuitton. Right? When they hired one girl DJ in New York City when there was like 25,000 of us. And I would feel grateful, but I couldn't get excited about it. I didn't enjoy it when I was there, when I was like, you know, and I'd take that photo of me at the DJ booth, but inside I was like miserable.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
And, but I'd post the photo and everyone would be like, oh my God, your life. And then that would kind of make me feel even worse. And I think when you do have high functioning anxiety, high functioning insert mental health issue there, at least for me, it hindered the urgency that I should have addressed my mental health with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing, because I feel like, too, people, I mean, we know the podcast is based on mental wellness, but it's good where people can still hear, you know, the things that you as the host have gone through or walked through or might still be walking through. And so thank you for still showing up.
Oh my gosh, right? It is what I live for, but I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. Are you in a place, look at me interviewing you.
you are so a host too.
Are you in a place where you are now enjoying what you do? Even as lives, are you still enjoying?
Yes. I tend to procrastinate a lot. And when I procrastinate, that is directly linked to my anxiety, aka if it's high, I procrastinate. If my anxiety is high, I'm not so good.
Has it gotten worse because of the social media and the everything is on our phone?
100%. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. So
like, I
we
hate
just
myself
have to,
when I see my screen time.
Yeah.
Oh, you know?
I get so excited though when it says your screen time was 10% lower.
Me too. Oh my God. Well, by the way, that's either that notification of elation or just brings you down like a rock tethered to your foot.
Yeah, no, I get excited about that.
Same.
Because there are some moments we live in a very anxiety-ridden world, and some of us have high anxiety jobs, and so we have to be intentional about our own self-care and some of the stuff that we're even anxious about never happens. It's just stuff we're playing in our mind because maybe we're analytical or maybe we're weighing the pros and cons of, well, this could happen. It's not.
Yeah.
And even if it does, you have all the tools. If and should it happen, you have all the tools you need right then and there to help. But we be forecasting stuff that's in our minds that's not going to happen.
Yeah, totally. It's like doomsday thinking.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
For people with mental struggles, I feel we always have one year that's Schitt's McGee. And learning about your 2018, I could not help but smile because it was exactly like my 2019. I broke up with my boyfriend. I left my job and I checked into a psychiatric hospital. And it's Schitt's McGee. But it's also the most transformational year of my life I've ever had. It set the foundation for who I am today.
You're right. No, it was a transformational year. I mean, 2018, you know, top of the year, rehearsing for Coachella, got engaged in March of 2018, did Coachella
publicly.
Which was dumb. 2018 of April, do Coachella, kill it. But I was experiencing high depression even during those high times, but I didn't want to tell anybody because we were having such a good time rehearsing. And then my relationship and the engagement, I was like, there's no way I'm going to like break the news to anybody that I'm suffering with depression. I know what to do. I'm going to get through this. Well, I didn't get through it. And in July of 2018, I had it. I couldn't pull myself up out the pit. And I called my therapist. They were aware. She was aware of what was going on and found a treatment facility for me and checked in. And at that time, I didn't care who was going to know me when I checked in, because when you're seeking help, shame goes out the window by that point. Okay.
And you were in a pit so deep.
I knew I wanted to get out. I had hope to live. I wanted to live. And so I check in. I'm in there a couple days. And then my manager calls the hospital and they're like, we've got a situation where TMZ knows what's going on. We've got to figure something out. And so I said, no, I don't want them to tell it. Let me tell it. And so he and my publicist, we put our heads together and he was like, he said something so profound. He said, you're okay. He said, you're doing what you've told people for many years, that if you need help, go get help. And I said, that's all I need to say in my statement, is that I'm doing the same thing that I've told thousands of people over the years to do, which was to get help. And I was like, what am I going to do now that the world knows? I was eventually going to tell it. I just didn't know when. Yeah, I didn't want to be the poster child for mental health, but I'm so glad that it's been cemented in my purpose in life, you know, to tell people it really is going to be okay. And even if you have to get help, it does not make you a bad person. You can still live a great life, you know, with whatever disease you have.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You're going to make it. Going to take some work and a lot of support. My heart goes out to people who feel like they don't have support. And it's like, man, if you can get one person or two people who have the patience, you know, you're going to make it. And so going on almost 5 years later, I look back like that was a dark time.
Yeah.
That was a dark time. We made it through, though. Mm-hmm. I made it through. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for asking.
The idea that you were forced to, quote unquote, out yourself because of TMZ.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so sorry. And I mean, I don't even know how the hell they'd even find out. Obviously,
I don't know.
But like, what the fuck? It's like, it's the most.
I do not know how people find this information out. And then I'm like, TMZ, I know y'all have a job to do, but this is why people who need help, who know they need help, don't go get help.
100%.
Because they're like, somebody's eventually going to find out. But you have to be in a place to where be so strong and solid that you're like, you know what? I don't even care.
When they did run the story, did they other you in any sort of way?
No, they didn't. I think they used a horrible picture where they caught me talking or something and it made me look
crazy.
They made me look like I was walking into the hospital at that moment.
So manipulative.
Like, you could have used a fabulous picture.
Of which there are many,
there
by the
are
way.
Tons of them.
Instead of this YouTube
and so they
half-
used me. I don't know. I was just like, oh my gosh. But they really printed what we printed. And they just printed, hey, you know, as reported, she is or has checked into a treatment facility for depression. I don't remember everything. But the one thing I do remember, I was like, you know, you and your people could have picked a better picture.
I just feel for you because I remember I came out on the girl I was dancing to Destiny's Child with in 6th, 7th, 8th grade. So she has a podcast. And I came out about my mental health journey on her podcast. And it was the first time I said anything out loud. And it was nerve-wracking for me beyond belief. Because even when I was in the treatment center and my friends would call me and ask me where I was, I would just straight up lie to them. I would say that I was at a mindfulness retreat. I went off social media completely. I just resolved to take this thing to the grave.
Mm-hmm.
So that first moment where I sat with Brooke and said, not only to her, but this was a live recording in front of in an audience. So said to everyone that I had gone to a psychiatric hospital, which is just loaded with shame and stigma.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrifying for me, but I did that on my own time. Yeah. I did not have a news corporation threatening me to release my story at a time when I was not ready.
Mm-hmm.
So I just massively feel for you because that moment of telling people, even if they know you're depression and anxiety prone, I would personally have been terrified.
No, I mean, it was terrifying because one of the nurses came in and shut my curtains because she was like, we don't know if someone has a long lens and they're going to figure out which room you're in. And so I was like, oh, I had a beautiful view. you know?
Open these like, windows.
Open these windows. Open these curtains. But I will say, being in that treatment facility, everybody looked like us. I just knew there was going to be someone visibly looking like they should be here. And I didn't see that. Now, I'm sure there was a ward, a separate ward of maybe more severe cases, maybe where people needed to be kind of stabilized, maybe. But where I was, you wouldn't even really know.
Right.
Until you sat down to hear people's stories.
So you were inpatient then?
I was inpatient, yes.
Yeah, I was too.
Mm-hmm.
What was a day like for you there?
Oh, the powdered eggs were horrible, but I knew I needed to eat. And I was like, I know those eggs are powdered. I know they're not scrambling all these eggs. I know they're not, I know they're not breaking these eggs.
Right, right.
And these are powdered for sure.
So food was not so good. Listen, I mean, I'm so with you here, so.
So they check in on you a lot.
Yeah.
Probably to ensure that you haven't found a way to harm yourself or anything like that.
Did they take away your razors and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No phones, no purses, no nothing. Mm-hmm. I went in with nothing, really, to the point where the nurses had to go to a store and buy undergarments and stuff for me to wear.
Oh, wow.
Because I didn't tell anybody. I don't think I told anybody where I was, so I wasn't finna call, hey, I need some underwear and pajamas. I'm at the treatment facility. Can you drop them off?
So you didn't even really pack anything when you went?
No. I was that desperate for help that I just took my purse and my insurance cards.
Wow. So you didn't have an appointment. You just like showed up, suitcase in hand, at the front door.
No suitcase, just my purse.
Okay, wow.
Purse and phone. And then when you check in, they take all of that. They let you write down some numbers. Kind of like I think if you were being booked for jail.
Yeah, I was just going to say it sounds
like if you memorize a number or two, you're welcome to call whoever you need to call. Let them know, you know. So it was kind of like that where I wrote some numbers down that I didn't have memorized. And I told who I needed to tell at the time. I was shooting episodes of Raven's Home for Disney. Mm-hmm. And I was like, y'all got to tell them I'm not going to be able to show up tomorrow.
Right.
Meaning I missed work. And that was a scary thing of will I ever be booked again for television shows?
And did part of that fear come from this TMZ story, knowing that everyone would know?
No. It came from my management having to make the phone call because I didn't want them to lie about anything.
Right.
I didn't want them to just say she was sick.
Right.
I worked sick all the time. I was like, we got to be honest and so that they can know the severity that I just didn't skip out on work because I have a headache.
Totally.
You know.
And I ask because I do have friends that are too scared to tell the HR department at their workplaces that they struggle with anything mentally because then they go, well, why would we hire this person? Or why would we keep this person during layoffs when they are liable to the company and have this pre-existing condition, which is so sad.
Well, first of all, it's understandable because you've got bills to pay. You probably have a family you've got to provide for, or you have a way of life that could significantly change if said organization decides to get rid of you. But then why do I feel like you have a legal situation on your hands?
Yeah.
You cannot, I don't know, but I would assume unless something is hampering the quality of work that you do, I think you should be able to get some time off to go get the help that you need. I just hate that, especially with our healthcare, that people are in a position to sacrifice their well-being because they're like, if I tell my boss, it's a possibility that I won't have this job.
Right.
Because let's be honest, we still live in a society to where people are just now learning, you know, about mental illness and the importance of mental health awareness. Everyone has mental health. Everyone.
No one is exempt.
Everyone has mental health, just like we have a cardiovascular health, reproductive health. Now, everyone does not have mental illness, but we all have mental health that we have to be aware of and take care of.
It's funny, to your point about how not everyone has a mental struggle or illness, and I actually don't use the word illness because I feel if you subscribe to a term, you become it. So for me, I call them mental struggles because I feel like it is possible to overcome them. So that's where the word, that's where it comes from. But actually, stat-wise, it is something that majority of people are not exempt from.
Every human being probably has something that can be diagnosed out of the DSM.
Yeah, totally. Like, Diagnostic Statistical Manual, by the way.
Everybody's mm-hmm. going to have something, totally. Right? And just because you might even, everybody could have anxiety. We don't know it. You're just not diagnosed with it.
Yeah.
You might not call it depression, but maybe you had some times where, you know, over the weekend you were really, really, really low. So mm-hmm. we like to use that term. I was just really, really, really low.
Right.
And I tell people, like, I don't use a diagnosis as anything other than data and information.
Same.
Because it's like, okay, tell me what I got. Okay. That's data and information.
Totally.
Then I go do what I need to do with that data and information to be well.
Totally.
That's it. Like you said, it is not a label. That's not who, depressed is not who you are.
Mm-mm.
That's not who you are. And anxious is not your name. That's not who you are. You know, you carry some of that with you at this time until you're getting the tools and resources to kind of like literally grab it
mm-hmm.
and get a hold of it. I know life will life. You know, I'm walking through a situation now where, you know, instead of like being, I'm allowing myself to have the emotions, the anger, I'm allowing myself to have the worry, I'm allowing myself to, they say, feel the feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
I want to talk about quickly the tips and tricks you have
mm-hmm.
for when you are in a rut, when you mm-hmm. do slip back into depression. I don't know mm-hmm. how often you do that now, or if you feel like the episodes are less and less.
The episodes are less and less. I've had moments where I could slip back into depression.
Mm-hmm. What keeps you out of them?
Just going back into that routine. Make your coffee.
Right.
Make your bed.
The micro steps.
Don't ignore what's going on around you. But to me, it seemed like depression was how I responded to things or how I responded to unmet needs. Now I voice the need that I have. How many people are living in depression because of fear of stating a need they have?
Right.
And it's turned into anger and resentment and shame at yourself for not speaking up for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so I just refuse to get back in the bed. I get back in the bed when it's time to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just have too many tools to slip into depression. I have too many resources.
Right.
I love certain apps, you know, to go to sleep at night.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a time where people would use their phones to look up mess, right?
What do you mean mess?
Like drama.
Okay, got it.
Remember like World Star? Like kids and grown
up. World Star?
Girl, where people could look up people fighting.
I've never heard of this before.
Where there could be like somebody videoing, oh, did y'all hear about this fight that happened at school? Well, look on so-and-so. It's probably on that site.
Oh, my God. It's like the dark web for trauma.
You gotta go look up what the meaning of the word trauma means, because that's what's going on right there. And you are experiencing trauma by watching it. You just don't know.
Why would anyone want to trigger themselves? That is crazy to me.
We are calling trauma entertainment. That is traumatic.
Yeah, that's insane, too.
When we have to look at people being killed, that is traumatic. Even, I'm glad that they have released, like, say, footage of certain things going on in the country shooting-wise, but it's traumatic to watch in real time what looks like Iraq, but it was Kentucky.
Right.
That's traumatic. I was like, and then my heart went out to the person, like the cops having to do all of that. And I'm like, that's a lot of information, right? So we can look up that stuff. We can look up questions that we need to ask and look up therapists in your community. Because therapy, you don't always have to process trauma. You can process transition. You can get therapy to say, I need your help. I need your perspective on this, because too many people are close to this situation that I'm in right now. I need your perspective or life coaching, right? So I just feel like everybody needs somebody to talk to. Again, I'm grateful where people say, man, I just didn't have that type of childhood. I had a loving childhood. When I tell you, I hug you, like, that's amazing. But don't think that
you don't have trauma.
You don't have certain traumas 100%. Or Maybe you don't think something was trauma, but it was dysfunction. Because a lot of people feel like it wasn't dysfunction because you survived it and you became successful. Like, no, that you survived dysfunction.
Totally.
And that's okay.
Totally. And I think it's funny because I, for so long, was refusing to look at my childhood because my parents are together. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a roof over my head and we could put food on the table. Mm-hmm. They paid for my college education. Mm. Sure, I was bullied in high school or whatever and had my own mental struggles. Mm-hmm. But I said, that's mine. I'm exempt from trauma because I didn't have like capital T trauma.
Yeah.
Right? And my parents never physically abused me or verbally abused me objectively, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. So as a result, I was like, I don't have right to even claim that any part of my childhood was trauma. And it was only through therapy that my therapist would be like, what your parents said to you, that is trauma. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, yeah, but that's not. And they're like, why are you defending them? Everyone is guilty, but no one is to blame.
Yeah, no one's to blame because when we think about, say, our parents, until you go to therapy or just have some spiritual awakening, you will begin to have compassion for your parents because you have two individuals with their own baggage and trauma. They come together as one and they're married. Then they produce offspring. Mm-hmm. So you have to try to care for yourself as an individual, care for the other person in the marriage, and then care for the children with your own unpacked trauma. Mm-hmm. And then it bleeds and trickles into the family dynamics, right?
Totally.
I don't think parents mean or intentionally say something to somebody to hurt you, unfortunately. And then when it gets physical, it's kind of like, woo,
that's a whole different thing.
You've got some trauma and some issues to unpack, but I began to have compassion for my parents and trying to break down even what they went through as children, mm-hmm, you know, that they never got to unpack. And then you bring that into marriage.
Right.
You know, so now I feel like I've got a good head start into should I choose to go into marriage. And I believe it will be healthier than I've ever seen. And because I'm going to make sure that person, they've unpacked their own trauma, right? I'm not getting with nobody that ain't never been to therapy. I'm sorry.
Amen.
No judgment if you haven't. But I just need us to be aware. Even like you said, even if you had a good upbringing, I just want to know, have you processed anything?
Same.
Do you know how to get to the root of things?
And biggest red flag is when men or partner of any gender says that they do not need it,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that they're exempt from it, especially if they've never even tried it. For me, that's like such a red flag.
Yeah. And we're not trying to make somebody have an issue.
No. Okay. But just look at yourself.
Yeah, but like you said, because it makes me know that in this relationship, you have humility to look at yourself.
Yeah.
To say, I am not perfect. Don't have it all the way together. Is life going good? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, but life will life. And I need to know that we have the tools that something doesn't collapse because we didn't have the tools.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that we're building on a sure, strong foundation, not one of sand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You referenced earlier that you went through some trauma when you were younger. Do you feel comfortable talking about that?
Definitely. When a child sees parents not getting along, that's traumatic because the child wants to fix it. The child just wants peace. I've had bullying. You know.
What kind of bullying were you?
Oh my gosh, horrible bullying, physical bullying, taunting. Threats. I mean, as a child, even though you don't follow through with the threat, could you imagine going all day wondering, are they going to beat me up at recess or are they going to beat me up after school? I got a long way to walk to the car. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's very, so when my therapist said, oh my gosh, you grew up ridden with anxiety, then you choose a career with things that has anxiety all in it. No wonder you've got anxiety, right? So I think, too, I don't have children, but it's amazing how adults have to be careful about how they handle their adult situations in front of their children.
Mm-hmm.
you know, take it outside as much as you can.
Yeah.
You know, because your children are sponges.
They hear everything and they know so much more than you think they do.
You don't know that they're absorbing all of that toxic energy.
Mm-hmm.
They are. Those children are absorbing it all. They're watching it all. And then you're teaching them how to handle conflict.
Full circle moment. When I'm assuming you did end up telling Tina that you went to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
How was that for you? And how did she
respond? Amazing.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Even when I got out the hospital in 2018, she cooked a huge dinner for me and some of my close friends.
So sweet.
Truffle mac and cheese, turkey, fried cabbage. I mean, oh my gosh, it just did her good to know that, you know, I was brave and took the steps to get the help needed and has been supportive, so supportive. I just love Beyonce, Kelly, Tina, Matthew, Richard, Solange, Angie, everybody that comes with that family were a part in my life changing. And so those are my hearts.
Mm-hmm. And you guys are still close today?
To this day. Mm-hmm.
When was the last time you saw them?
Gosh, a couple weeks ago. I'm going to see them next week. So,
do you guys all do the like reunions in different, because you're all in different cities, right?
All in different cities. So when people say, when are y'all reuniting? I'm like, we reunite all
yesterday.
The time. We just don't put it on Instagram.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm grateful for the experience. I'm grateful that, you know, even my life and time in Destiny's Child has afforded me the resources that I have now and opened so many doors. And as a solo artist and now a public speaker and author, it's just been a joy. Every time that I transition, you know, still having the favor of my past follow me is a blessing.
Last question.
Okay.
What drives you?
What drives me is purpose and impact that I have walking in my purpose.
That, my friends, was Michelle Williams. You can follow her on Instagram at Michelle Williams and me at Gillian Sagansky. As always, I want to hear what you think of this episode and any episode. So shoot me a DM and please don't forget to subscribe and rate us so we know you're out there alive and kicking and listening. Until next time.